I'm Stephanie J. Block.
And I'm Mary Lee Fairbanks. And we host Stages Podcast. Binge close to 100 episodes. Hear the inside stories from backstage and behind the scenes as we go beyond the resume and into the heart of creativity and what it really takes to be in the business of show business.
Don't miss our chats with this season's Tony nominees. If you love theater and entertainment, you are going to love Stages Podcast.
Subscribe to Stages Podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts and visit us at stagespodcast.net.
Are we okay for noise, by the way? It's Friday night. Yeah.
It's Friday night.
Friday night.
It's Friday night. We should do some singing.
We could do
that
something.
That was so funny the other night.
It wasn't that great. I know. Just to sing. And what did we say? We sang.
Still my guitar.
That's right.
Gently weeps.
She was great. And we sang. I love to sing. In June of this year, completely unsure about what to do with Damien Hirst's beautiful studio space next to the River Cafe, which he was giving to us for the memorial for Richard Rogers, my husband, a friend, Jonah Freud, introduced me to S. Devlin by text. A few hours later, I found myself talking to her while she put her child to bed at midnight. S., the designer of the set for Beyoncé's concert, the West End production of The Crucible, the fashion show for Yves Saint Laurent, had recently finished her radical book, An Atlas of S. Devlin. At the end of the conversation, she said, "I'll tell you what, Ruthie, I'm going to Lisbon tomorrow morning. Why don't I stop over on the way to the airport? Is 8 o'clock okay?" "Of course, S.," I said, already exhausted. She arrived at 8 on the dot. We had a look at the space. She told me what to do and got straight into a taxi to make the flight. This was S. Spontaneous, generous, positive, creative, funny, and very smart. As I write this, S. is in the restaurant talking to Charles Pullen, our manager, about what makes the River Cafe a set, a place that is active and calm, dark and light, noisy and quiet at different times of the day. When S comes back from all this, we'll talk about food, theater, space, books, family, and cooking. And most of all, we will talk about friendship and we will talk about love. Thank you, S.
Oh, so beautiful. Don't change a word.
So, you know the drills, and we asked you to choose from all the recipes of all the books in the last 12 cookbooks. So I'd like to ask you why you chose this recipe for cannellini bean soup.
This is from the first book. And, of course, my first encounter when the River Cafe first was open, when I was first able to come, which took a while to get my table. And then when the book came out and we were fans. So I wanted to remember that moment.
You and...
Well, back then, it was probably me and friends. It was probably before I met my husband, Jack. But my husband, Jack, is an extraordinary cook. He makes this cannellini bean soup. And he makes it very specifically with a piece of toast in the bottom. And he did teach me how to make it. Mm-hmm. So I have made it.
Okay.
But more often, I have eaten it when I didn't make it. Yeah, I ate the love of it rather than making it. Okay. Shall I read it?
Read the recipe.
Cannellini bean soup. Serve 6. 250 grams cooked cannellini beans. A handful of fresh sage leaves. 2 to 3 garlic cloves peeled and chopped. 3 tablespoons of olive oil. A bunch of fresh flat-leaf parsley chopped. Extra virgin olive oil. In a large saucepan, cook the garlic in the olive oil until soft but not brown. Add the parsley, then add beans and stir. Put 3/4 of the bean mixture into a food processor with some reserved cooking liquid. Pulse briefly, you do not want to puree. Add more of the cooking liquid if necessary, but the soup should be thick. Return to the saucepan and season. Reheat. If too thick, add more cooking liquid. Serve with generous amount of extra virgin olive oil.
And perhaps some toast.
And I would, if I were Jack, I would be toasting something in the bottom so you have that gorgeous toast and beans and oil.
Yeah, that's what we love. Almost three ingredients, isn't it? You know, simplicity, which I guess is perhaps the way you work.
It is. And also, I don't eat meat. So as you mentioned, I use quite a lot of energy.
Yeah.
So I have to be quite careful to make sure I get a lot of protein without eating meat. And the beans are amazing for that as well.
So going back to the beginning, tell me about growing up in the Devlin household. Where were you born?
I was born in Kingston Hospital in Kingston-upon-Thames, not too far from here. Proper suburbia.
Yeah, close.
Proper suburbia in the western suburbs of London. And then my parents went on a romantic weekend break to Rye in East Sussex. Mm. And they bought a house on a whim on a cobbled street called Mermaid Street, which used to descend into the sea. And the house had been lived in by Conrad Aiken, the poet, and his daughter, Joan Aiken, the author. So in my mind, the house spoke. There was a model city, model town of Rye next to the house. And we used to visit it every weekend because my mother and father were so excited to invite their friends to see the place they loved. So they would take them to the model, which was a Sonnet Lumière, and it told stories. So each house told a story, including my house. So I was only 6 years old. So in my head, something made me think that objects could speak.
Stories.
Houses could speak the way that I think beans speak and food speaks. So that was me growing up. And my mother was a teacher.
What did she do?
She taught special needs children, dyslexic children at that time. She had taught lots of things, but she was teaching dyslexic kids. And my dad was a journalist specializing in education. They were both fascinated with education, actually. Yeah. But my mom prepared all the food. My dad could make scrambled eggs on toast. That was really it. I'm worried that I might be, like my father was, slightly known for only cooking one thing.
Okay.
Because I don't cook very much.
That's fine. What is your one thing?
Well, I do make cheese and tomatoes on toast quite well. If it's good toast. Sometimes put red pepper. I'm trying to use the vegan cheese.
What's that like? Are you vegan or vegetarian?
No, I'm vegetarian, but I'm just trying to be as smart as possible with the ingredients. But yeah, my mum was in the kitchen. She was trying to manage everything. There were four kids.
Four, and she taught all day and then came home and cooked for you.
Yeah.
Would you sit down, all of you, to dinner every night?
Yeah, but it was quite a lot of, you know, back then in the 80s and late 70s, quite a lot of potato waffles. Mm-hmm. Out of the freezer, whatever she had time for. Then she got a slow cooker and she realized that before she went to work, she could put all the ingredients, big meaty stews. She would do a white one or a brown one. And she put all the ingredients, the chicken or whatever it was, in there in the morning.
Wow.
She'd go out, do her whole day at teaching. And then we would come home from school. The idea was that the big stew would be there for us to eat.
And that worked.
Well, no, because we like the potato waffles.
Oh, I see.
So we would just go to the freezer and get my poor mum. So she gave up after that a bit.
So your father would come back. Would he work in London or where did he work as a journalist?
Yeah, we only saw him at the weekend.
Oh, really?
Because he would stay up in London to get to Rye at the time.
Yeah.
It was quite a trek.
Yeah, yeah.
So he would come back at the weekends. So my mum was really holding the fort and we all did a lot of things. There was music lessons, orchestra. We had a little yellow Citroen Diane that we had to park facing downhill on Mermaid Street. Otherwise, it wouldn't start if it was facing uphill. Because then if it didn't start, you could just roll it down.
Yeah.
She would put hot water bottles on it in the winter to stop the points freezing. She had a little plastic, like a bonnet that you put on to stop your hair getting wet in the shower. She put one of those over the whole car. A big bonnet to stop it getting wet. But we would go to the beach after school in the summer every day to Camber Sands or to Winchelsea. And my food memory of that time was sitting, usually crappy weather, in the wind and unwrapping foil, crusty little pastries. And then the grit of the sand would get in them. And she would make these little pastry chicken pies. So I remember the chicken and the sand. They were kind of tasty with a bit of sand in them.
Amazing. So you grew up in this house with four children. Where are you in the list of kids?
I'm number two.
Number two. And the mother who worked, a father who was absent, and you had a meal every night that you would sit around the table. And would you all talk about what you'd done during the day?
Yes.
Or would it be just kind of eat and then do the homework? What was
very
it? What was
noisy.
Life like? Noisy.
Very noisy. Mm-hmm. And kind of my brothers went to boarding school for a while. I think it was all too much probably for my mom to manage four kids all at once. So they went off for a bit and they would come back in the holidays and it was very, very noisy. And there were friends over. And yeah, it was food and noise and talking.
And at lunch, would you take your lunch to school? Or did you get lunch there? Do you remember school food?
School food, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. School food was horrible. Rice puddings that were all skinny and you had to eat it all. It was a local school called Frida Cardam in Rye, a primary school. And then we moved to Kent to go to a school called Cranbrook School, which was a grammar school. Mm. They had a little cafeteria that you would choose your food, but we just did eat the potato waffles.
So again, back to the potato waffles.
I'm afraid so. I'm afraid it's such
I
a shame.
I can't believe I've never seen a potato waffle. I guess I have to go through the British education home system. Have you had a potato waffle?
Yeah, okay. I mean, in fairness to my mum, the fact that, you know, we were annoying children who liked processed food was not her fault. She's a fantastic cook. She makes great big themed, I mean, she would make ridiculously crazy birthday cakes.
Theatrical, perhaps?
Extraordinarily theatrical. I mean, my mum is a great artist, as is my dad. They didn't pursue art as a career, but all of our birthdays were always, it would be a themed mermaid cake with mermaid biscuits. I'm pretty terrible because I do, when I eat a meal, and I've been served the most beautiful meals in my life by my husband and other, but I tend to eat the conversation.
Yeah.
The food tastes of the thought.
That's fine. That's a story. That's a story of food. And I think food can be a story.
And I think, you know, what you eat is so much, obviously, more than what's going in your mouth. And the lighting, I am obsessed with what the light is. I can't, if I walk into a restaurant, the light is wrong, I will probably go up to the person and say, can I just dim this switch here?
So what is the lighting that you like in a restaurant?
Low. Or outside and being in the, like just now, we were sitting outside your beautiful piazza. Yeah. So either natural light or the light of the fire.
Yeah.
By the fire, the food by a fire.
Yeah.
I'm Charles Pullen, executive director of the River Cafe, and we are sitting on table 106 on the terrace outside on a Friday afternoon, and I'm about to talk with Ez Devlin. Very excitingly, we want to get her take on the feel and the energy and the design of the River Cafe. So rather than one of her sets that we do all over the world, it'd be rather interesting just for us to hear what your take is on the space that we use. As people arrive through the front door, their first view as they look left down the length of the very long dining room is the big pink wood oven and the fire in there flickering away, which has a wonderful purpose of shrinking the room in a way and making it feel cozy and make it feel much more intimate, despite the fact it is a very long, large dining room. It's such a sort of hackneyed old reference, the fact that there is so much in common with the theatre and the restaurant world. But it's a truism because there are so many parallels with how you gear up, you rehearse, you audition, but then there's the energy that just before service, just before the curtain's up, and then you all jump into your roles. And so we've always talked about the staff and the food and all that side of things, but from your point of view, it might be interesting to hear how the kind of design of the dining room itself comes into play.
I think the comparison between the performative aspects of the delivery of food and the physical aspects of being backstage and front stage are clear. I don't find them hackneyed. I think they're fascinating. When I was here last time, it was an evening. The weather was a bit like this, maybe not so sunny, but we all gathered in bright clothes in honour of Richard's love of bright colours all around the banks of this piazza. And, of course, the river. It's called the River Cafe for a reason. We are adjacent to this great planetary force that runs through our city. So, for me, those fundamental forces of the fire in the bright crimson furnace and the river that's here, this green piazza of grass that's outside, the vivid colour of the doors everywhere in the toilets, this beautiful red-orange fluorescent colour.
Richard's colours, exactly.
Right? So I think all of those energies are felt even when you're inside. We're sitting outside now, but I believe they're felt inside as well. And of course the colour, the idea that when you eat, you're not just eating food, you're eating colour, you're eating light, because the way that light reverberates off objects to create colour. You're eating what you smell. You're eating the conversation that you might be having with someone. That's what you're eating. That's what you're nourished by, so much more than molecules that you need as fuel, right?
Absolutely.
Of course. And that's, this place has always celebrated that. And of course, what's beautiful about it, my understanding of the etymology of this restaurant and why it's so dearly loved, is because it began as a place of work, didn't it? It began as a canteen to feed those who were working together to make buildings.
The paper tablecloth here was here so that Richard could get out his pens and scribble on them and design the next comedy, whatever it might have been.
And I think that's why it feels so rooted in this spot. It's here for more reasons than one might think, even on the surface. Of course, now it's become this incredibly sought-after place to have some of the finest food, with the finest produce, with some of the most successful and accessible and readable and beautiful cookbooks that have ever been made. But it started because a team at lunchtime needed to eat in a place where there aren't many restaurants. Yeah. And it started from, we always talk about, in any kind of work of art, what was the need? Did it need to be made? And this needed to be made. Like Ruthie and Richard needed to be together. Yeah. Like, you know, their need of each other sort of resonated through all their friends and the vast kind of circle of people they've gathered around them, which I really witnessed when I was here on that memorial day.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Help helps is a maxim I believe in. We all carry around stress and hardship, and when we keep it inside, it starts to chip away. Therapy is a safe place, and therapy is for everyone. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Visit betterhelp.com/Ruthie today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Ruthie. BetterHelp.com/Ruthie.
I'm Stephanie J. Block.
And I'm Mary Lee Fairbanks.
And we host Stages Podcast. Binge close to 100 episodes. Hear the inside stories from backstage and behind the scenes as we go beyond the resume and into the heart of creativity and what it really takes to be in the business of show business.
Don't miss our chats with this season's Tony nominees. If you love theater and entertainment, you are going to love Stages Podcast.
Subscribe to Stages Podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts and visit us at stagespodcast.net.
I understand, though, that you cook for the people that you work with. Is that right? Yeah. Every day?
So I don't cook, but I have a cook who makes meals every day. And we started that probably about 7 years ago when we moved to a studio that didn't really have an easy way for people to eat. But also it was part of balancing our carbon footprint. Mm-hmm. And it seemed much more sensible if I have around 8 to 10 people in the studio every day. We make them vegetarian food. There's no food waste. There's no packaging. No one's running around getting bits of things in plastic boxes or anything. It was something I could do. You know, we still fly. I can diminish it, but I can't completely get rid of that from my practice at the moment. But what I can do is serve everyone a really nice vegetarian
meal. Do you all eat together?
Yeah, we will stop work, go around the table in my house. There's a garden there. We all sit down and we eat. We have a wonderful lady called Chaya who's cooking for us at the moment. We had Antonia until she had to leave. But that's really important for me, that we sit, we talk to each other, we eat great food.
I think that, again, how you combine work and food, you know, there are people who need to go out and go for a walk to stop. There are people, you know, the idea of the business lunch where you go to a restaurant and you discuss work, which was an anathema to Renzo Piano, Richard's partner. He thought, I remember when they were doing the Pompidou, it was like either you ate or you worked. You never would combine the two, you know, the idea of enjoying a meal while you talked about work. Do you continue the work over the meal or is it?
Usually not. Normally we just talk about stuff we wouldn't talk about. Yeah. It's not worky over lunch. And everyone goes out for a walk after lunch because we're near Dulwich Park.
Oh, that's fine.
So people go out, they wander off, they get a coffee, they have a little break. But normally, no, the conversation, either we're silent sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes we just need a break and we all sit there. We're happy in each other's company just eating. We're very happy to say nothing.
Yeah.
Or we just chit-chat about any old thing that's nothing to do with work. Or we invite people to lunch a lot of the time. There are a lot of kids who want to see the studio who might not otherwise experience what a studio is like. So we're busy, but we're always stopping for lunch. So we say, come to lunch. Yeah. So they come, they get the vibe. Everyone's not panicking because they're not meant to be working. Mm-hmm. It's a time for a break.
And you're quite solitary?
I love being on my own. I love reading. I always draw when I read. I write when I read. I draw, I have to underline. I can't read without a pen in my hand. Mm-hmm. I love it on my own, but I don't spend very much time on my own because I have two children.
Yeah.
And I have 8 people in my studio minimum. So I'm rarely on my own. So I really cherish it when I am.
Because we were talking the other day about artists and alcohol and drinking and going out and being together in the evening, because so many artists are alone during the day that then when it's sort of over, you want to kind of go out, be out. And did you have that period in your life before you had children? Were you working and then partying to restaurants?
Yeah, I mean, I think the time when I moved to London, when I was a early teens, you know, it was magical. My boyfriend at the time was a...
16 is young.
I was young.
Well, your parents were fine with that.
Not really.
No.
Yeah, I was kind of determined in what I wanted to do. And it was music. My boyfriend at the time was a record producer and a sound engineer. So I was with a lot of musicians and I spent a lot of time in recording studios just observing how music is made, how tracks are recorded, how music is edited. So that was a really formative time to get under the skin of recording and music. And then when I was in Bristol, that was probably my most party time. That was my hallucinogenic moment.
Yeah. Tell me about then when you left home.
I was about 16 and I fell in love with a man who was 24. I did finish school, but I spent a lot of time in London.
Was that a domestic situation? Did you live in a house and have to cook and shop for yourself? Or did
no, but we, do you know, we had hardly ever been to a restaurant. Mm. When we didn't go to restaurants ever. We didn't have the money for kids in a restaurant. And restaurants in England at the time, it wasn't the same thing
what
as it is now.
What year is that? What are you talking about?
Well, as I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, we never went to a restaurant. I can remember going to a restaurant once.
Special occasion? Or
I think it was because the car broke down and we went and it had red walls and the Parmesan was off. That's all I remember about a restaurant.
Yeah.
So the first time I really remember going to restaurants was when I was 16 and I met my boyfriend and he would take me out in London to restaurants. Oh. And we went to Mr. Wing and we ate duck pancakes. It's in Earl's Court.
Yeah.
And Julie's restaurant.
Julie's in Holland Park.
In Holland. Yeah. Those were the restaurants. And I was like, wow, this is crazy.
Yeah. You know? So you ate in restaurants and maybe cooked for yourself? Or did
Yeah, then I did do a bit of cooking and I would have been at university when I got your book. I didn't have any furniture. I had a wooden pallet on the floor and I put cushions around it. And I would try and make the River Cafe recipes. That was when I first got the blue book.
And then you cooked your way through university? Did you stay there?
Yeah. Yeah. And I did cook then. I would eat veggie burgers in the cafe.
Were you vegetarian at that point?
I wasn't. No, I just liked the veggie burgers. Mm. I wasn't vegetarian then. I would make chicken. I would do Thai dinners. And I would get the galangal and lime and coconut milk and make chicken coconut milk soup. I would do that.
So when you left Bristol, then what did you do?
When I left Bristol, I had been writing, as you do. I was doing an English literature degree. So I was reading and writing, reading, reading, writing for 3 years. But I also wanted to paint. So I painted a lot. I painted my whole house, which was rented.
And that kind of painting?
No, I was painting
murals.
You
painted murals on the walls, did you?
Yeah.
Wow.
And it was a rented apartment. And it had a shag pile carpet that I ripped off. Yeah. It was disgusting. It had carpet all over the side of the bath. So I took all the carpets away and painted on the floor, great big murals, and painted I made a lot of things.
Did your landlord ever stop by to visit?
No, no, but I got in trouble when I left. I had to put it all back, I had to get new shag pile carpet, put it all back.
So underneath some person's apartment, you should go back there and lift up the carpet and be
see
like, you know,
there.
Discovering a Michelangelo under a canvas, you know, there's a nest
still there.
Waiting there.
Have a look in number 135, Cotton Brow, 139, I can't remember. But so I wanted to make art then.
Yeah.
And I went to St. Martin's. And I did the foundation course.
Oh, so after university, you went to...
I did it all back to front.
It's not bad to have one education and then have another.
I wasn't ready to go to art school.
Yeah.
Although I'd always made art at school, I wasn't ready to go to art school, not least because if you went to art school, you had to stay living at home. Yeah, and I wanted to move. Yeah. I wanted to live in Bristol. So, yeah, I went to St. Martin's and had the most, you know, rich year of just... I was a mature student by then. Everyone else was 18. I was 21 and quite old. So I did everything there, you know, really got into photography, printmaking, sculpture, made a lot of books. I sewed a book. I decided a book had to be made completely stitched. And then people kept saying to me, oh, you really should check out this theatre design course.
At St. Martin's?
There was a specific one called Motley Theatre Design Course, which was run by a 93-year-old lady called Percy Harris, who's a bit of a legend in the world of stage design. And I said, I don't really care about theatre. You know, it's quite boring. I never sit through. I'm always asleep. Or it's a musical. It's kind of embarrassing. I don't want to do theatre. And they said, no, no, just go and check out this course. And I walked in, and it was this red room, smell of pot noodle, definitely saw a mouse.
And where was it?
It was in the scene dock of the Theatre Royal Drury Lane.
Okay.
At the time, there was Miss Saigon, so every night you would hear the helicopter coming down. And it was just 10 students, pretty much feral, slightly smelly. They hadn't left that room for a year.
Wow.
They were just in. And they were making, they had little model theatres, they were listening to opera, there was references and, you know, photographs and paintings stuck all over the wall. And I thought, this is my tribe. I'm happy here. Mm. And I've never really left that room in a way. Whatever I'm making, it's in a room. My room now is kind of like that.
What is it like?
It's covered in stuff, piles and piles of books, tons of little drawings and pictures all over the wall, lots of little sculptures, quite magical, lots of miniatures.
You have a beautiful voice. Did you sing?
Do you know, I did try and sing occasionally. I was so bad. Yeah. Funny enough, I've learned to use my voice a bit now. When I make sculptures, I speak in them.
But tell me more about that. What do you mean?
Well, there's a work that's on in Miami at the moment called Forest of Us. Mm-hmm. And it starts as a small film with me talking, really just noticing the similarity between the shape of human lungs and the shape of trees. And just observing that, then the film comes apart and you walk into a sculpture that reverberates that observation. But when I first made these types of works in 2016, I would never have used my voice. Like a lot of people, if I heard my voice on an answering machine back in the day when we had answers, I'd be like, oh God, I don't sound like that. That's weird. I sound, you know, that's terrible. But I got used to it when I used to read my children's stories. When I put them to sleep. And I got used to the different quality of sound. If I had one of their heads on my chest, my voice sounded different. Mm-hmm. And I got used to that. And I kind of became comfortable with my own voice around then.
Stories and voice and theater and designing, this story of your growing up, decorating the cakes, to going to Bristol and cooking Thai food and putting murals under carpets. It's all about discovery and trying to find the story with the theme underneath it. And then food is the same. You have the ingredients. You try and think how you can respect the ingredient, the simplicity of the ingredient. If you're vegetarian, if you're vegan, if you're trying to do something with or without. It always is that kind of restraint which then leads to the richness, doesn't it?
I think so, and I think everything that you're just describing there is also about seeking a very basic human need for being participant in ritual.
Yeah.
And we were talking actually a little earlier about River Cafe and ritual, and you've got all the ingredients here for ritual. You have the river, you have the fire, you have that piazza of grass. Mm. And I think more and more it's what we lack. And it's what we seek. The storytelling voice is another way of calibrating time. It's such a tiny fragment of our existence as a species that we calibrate time with a clock, mechanical, digital. That's so recent. It was always calibration by means of planetary distance.
And what is the right time? When Richard was doing Lloyd's, they wanted to put a clock on the outside of the building. We went to Jean Tinguely and said, would you possibly design a clock? It was a whole long story, which is you had to call him at a certain time of day. And somehow I was very involved in this. And so I made the call and you had to tell him right away what you wanted. And so I said, Mr. Tinguely, we would, you know, this is Richard Rogers' wife, and we'd like to put a clock on the outside of Lloyd's. And he went, that's fantastic. I love Richard Rogers' work. I love Lloyd's. I love insurance. I love clocks. This is a brilliant idea. And he thought about it. We talked about it. And then he said, there's just one thing that if I design a clock for you, that's one condition. And I said, what would that be? And he said, the clock must not tell the correct time.
Wonderful.
And, you know, and of course, Lloyd's went next, you know, they were totally, but the idea that you could have a clock that you knew as a, you know, as a ritual, as a consistent, which would not be correct, is okay. I'll meet you under the Lloyd's clock, but I don't know what time that will be.
I think so. I think these other ways of calibrating time that are not digital, and I think one of the things I started doing, I was traveling a lot, too much for a while, and to sort of earth myself, I would, every morning when I would wake up, I wouldn't quite know where I was straight away. I didn't know. And I would just observe the light coming through the gap in the two curtains. And for a while, I'd just say, okay, I don't know anything else. I just know this line of light. And I started photographing them. And I've been doing it for about 20 years. And I now am in a state where in the morning, even if I wake up at home, I don't have curtains, I have blinds. So what you see are these two squares
of
light.
I have that too, yeah.
Beautiful squares of light. Mm. And actually the door doesn't quite shut properly, so I often get a line of light through the door. Mm. And I just sit with those. I set my alarm 20 minutes before I have to get up.
Which is what time?
Normally I get up around 7:30, but I try to just have that moment with the lines of light, yeah. Like a sort of, you know, the room is a sundial.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courtney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
I'm Stephanie J. Block.
And I'm Mary Lee Fairbanks. And we host Stages Podcast. Binge close to 100 episodes. Hear the inside stories from backstage and behind the scenes as we go beyond the resume and into the heart of creativity and what it really takes to be in the business of show business.
Don't miss our chats with this season's Tony nominees. If you love theater and entertainment, you are going to love Stages Podcast.
Subscribe to Stages Podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts and visit us at stagespodcast.net.
The River Cafe is excited to announce the return of our Italian Christmas gift boxes. Our alternative to the traditional hamper, the gift boxes bring you all of our favorites from the River Cafe kitchen, the vineyards, and the designers from all over Italy. They're available to pre-order now on shoptherivercafe.co.uk. Tell me about the most recent or most interesting set you've done, that you've worked on. Do we call them sets? Do you still call them sets?
Or you might call them a stage sculpture. I mean, I think historically, set design hierarchically.
Yeah, tell me about set design.
Well, it sometimes has been perhaps regarded as something decorative or something. So the only reason I am a little bit particular about the words I use to describe it is it just helps people to recognize that objects can be protagonists, that environments can speak, that places speak, that, you know, a cup, if it's picked up in a particular way under a particular light, can, you know, be vocal about stuff in the way that mountains can and rocks can and streams can, you know, and animals can. That's why I use stage sculptures a bit, just to kind of provoke a little bit. But a recent one, there's one at the moment, actually, at the Gielgud Theatre for The Crucible.
A book that we all, if you're American and you grew up in high school in America, we all read The Crucible. Tell me about The Crucible and the set.
Well, when you enter the space, it was at the Olivier Theatre at the National and now it's at the Gielgud Theatre. When you enter the space, it already confronts you because it is a living box of water pouring. And in the Gielgud particularly, it's somewhat unnerving because the Gielgud is a beautiful, ornate, iced cake of a proscenium Edwardian theatre. So it makes you anxious straight away to see this water pouring, like, is there a giant leak? But it's pretty powerful, and it already helps heighten the atmosphere. You know, there's always that terrible moment when you go in a theatre and you've bought your popcorn or whatever, you sit down, the seats are uncomfortable, you're with a friend, you're not sure if they're going to like it, they might find it boring, because theatre can be crap, you know, and crap theatre is some of the crappiest. You can imagine, because it's hard to do well. So if you sit down and you've got all those anxieties, will it be good? Will it be bad? Will I be bored? If already there's a gesture that's confident, that already says, I'm going to look after you.
Yeah.
I'll take care of you. You're safe. Yeah, you're safe with me. Then it's a bit like a restaurant, I guess. You walk in and the colors have been chosen. People already relax. And I think what happens is people become already tuned in a little bit to the vibration of the gesture.
Now, the set's usually lit then before you, when you sit down, you can see what it's going to be.
Yeah.
Is it dark going to light?
And, well, it varies, but I'm trying to, I guess, increase the porosity between the feeling of walking into the Turbine Hall or the Serpentine and the feeling of walking into the Gielgud Theatre. Mm. And I think if you walk in, there's already a sculpture there.
Yeah.
You engage in a different way. And then, of course, the music begins. And in this case, it's Caroline Shaw has done this extraordinary work with an extraordinary musical director as well. And these voices begin and they accost you. And you don't have time to worry anymore. You're grabbed.
Do you work with the director from the very first, when he starts or she starts thinking about how the play is going to be directed? Because I do that with a book. We don't write the recipes and then talk to the photographer and the graphic designer. We all sit around a table and think, what is this? What is every page going to be? How are we going to photograph this before we even cook it? Or how are we going to make the page make you want to cook a recipe and make it clear? So it all starts with that. And is that the way it is with you?
Yeah, with Lindsay Turner, she's the director of The Crucible, and she and I have worked together now for quite a long time, for 10 years, actually. I spent quite a lot of time on a farm in Sussex, and she came down there.
You haven't told me that yet.
A little farm. I only just got it. I haven't done much with it yet. I've got big ambitions. What are you going to grow?
What do you want to do? This is a diversion from The Crucible, but let that slip.
My dream would be that the people in my studio who are on computers a lot of the time, I would really like it that on a Friday or maybe once a month or however often we can do it, they would come to the farm and put their hands in the earth. And it's just a visual symmetry as well. If these hands are on computer keys all the time and these imaginations are everywhere, but the nature of our practice is they're making models, but a lot of the time they're on computers. And I think it'd be beautiful for them to be hands in earth, you know, helping to grow the food that we then eat. That would be the dream. Yeah, that's the dream. So that's what we're great. It takes a long time.
So you went to the farm with?
So I went to the farm with Lindsay and we sat and we read The Crucible. Mm. And we just read the whole thing aloud. And that's what we always do, is we read it so that the play exists between us. We just share the parts so that before we start even...
Before you even start.
Talking about
it. Was it her idea to put it on? Was it her... He brought it to the National?
She had the vision to do it and she had a really clear vision for how she wanted to do it. But even after that first reading, we started to say, what if the first scene was just this group of girls sitting at the back of the congregation, muttering, and then one of them gets slapped and we just see them from the back. So we sort of conjured the first scene and that led to the environment and the sculpture around it.
Would you direct yourself? Would you say I can do both?
Yeah, I sometimes do, especially with the music. Sometimes, but I really like the collaboration with the director. Yeah. I direct the materials and the, you know, how the light and the video and the materials might coalesce. And she directs the performers and the cast. And it's a lot of directing of different material and human things.
Do you go when your play is on? Do you go often to see it and have the set?
I go a few times. Yeah, I'm normally onto the next thing, but I love to go back.
Yeah.
You know, especially towards the end, towards the final night.
What was it like working with Beyoncé then, from The Crucible to Beyoncé? Or was it Beyoncé to The Crucible?
Well, I've been working with her for a long time because we started in 2015.
Oh, yeah.
That's a very big team. Lots of extraordinary collaborators over time, all over the world, and a massive production. And also with Abel Tesfaye, The Weeknd. So his stadium show was also happening at the same time. So there was one night where you could go and see Beyoncé or The Weeknd or another play called Dear England, which is really fun.
I'm going to see that on Monday, I really can't wait to see that.
I tell you what's fun about that is it's a really divided audience. Mm. It's an audience who love theatre but might not always be so interested in football.
Yeah.
It's an audience who really might not normally set foot in a theatre but love football, like my son who doesn't like theatre but likes football. Okay. So Ludo will come for that. And at the beginning, there's a little shiftiness, like, am I going to hate this? How's it going to be? And by the end,
yeah, no, everyone
is crying and singing yeah. Sweet Caroline yeah. together. And it's a bit like we've been talking a little bit about national assemblies mm. and how they might form a new kind of form of governance, a new ways to participate in democracy. Mm. And actually, at the end of that, it gives you hope that actually, given the right stimulus mm. and the right materials and environment, mm. people can find common ground.
When in the pandemic, when we closed the River Cafe, if you'd asked me what's important in the city, I would have said your theater, concerts, parks, playgrounds, hospitals, you know, put restaurants way down. But you realize that going to see what you're just describing, or to come perhaps to a restaurant and see people you might not have seen for years that you bump into, or that you, again, the thing of being taken care of, that you can walk in and feel that, you know, it's going to be okay. You might have had an argument or been stuck in traffic or lost your job or getting divorced or getting married or, you know, happy things are saved up for months to come. But that somehow when you, what you want, and I think what I want, both of us, is to have somebody walk through the door and feel it's going to be okay and leave feeling better than when they arrived.
I think so. And I think it comes back to ritual and the passing of time. Mm-hmm. Because if you've been working intensely, and you walk into a restaurant mm-hmm. and you know that there's going to be a new rhythm to the rest of that day. Mm-hmm. First, it's going to be the ritual, the welcome, the formalities, yeah. the choosing, the glass of whatever you're going to drink, the course one, the mm-hmm. course two. This is a clock mm-hmm. in itself. The same when you go to the theater. Yeah. And actually now, after having become temporarily extinct, all of my practice was temporarily extinct. Me and Jack, we both have devoted our lives to mass gatherings.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
suddenly mass gatherings were weapons of mass destruction.
What did you do?
Panicked.
Nah.
Talked a lot yeah. on Zoom. Mm. Became a radio station.
Yeah.
Would have been better to shut up and go off and do a sabbatical, but didn't.
But we didn't know.
I spent every day. Jack looked at me, he said, Ez, you're like a mad sort of ringleader yeah. doing Zooms. He said, just leave yeah. your people alone. They're happy to have some time off.
But somehow the contact was so important, wasn't it? I felt it was.
Well, how we feel now, like the other day going to the Weeknd's concert where it's 80,000, no screens, 80,000 people singing together, mm. 1 5-foot-8 man mm. holding 80,000 people mm. in a stadium. Mm. We're pinching ourselves. Yeah. Just thinking a few years ago, this felt like it would never happen again.
Yeah.
And for me, it's so vital. It's one of the most important things we do, I think,
being,
as humans.
Being together.
Yeah.
Oh, well, let's talk about this book.
Urgent.
Yeah, let's definitely talk about this book. I want you to describe this
okay.
to people who are listening about what we have at the table between you and myself.
So what's sitting in between me and Ruthie right now is a book. It's a small 22-centimeter square by about, I'm going to say about 8 centimeters thick. So it's a chunky object. And it's got a hole cut out of the front. And then in the following pages are more offset holes. And around the holes are drawn the names of everyone who's ever participated in any of the collaborative works that I've made over time. Then as you unfold its 1,000 pages, there are 700 images, mainly of a sort of parallel series of works that I've been making for 30 years. Small paper sculptures, paintings, drawings. And then finally, by the end, there's 50,000 words in it as well of text, of commentary. And then by the end, there are pictures of most of about 120 projects. So it's like doing a big end of year tax return.
How long did it take you to do this book?
I started it 7 years ago. And then my first deadline was 4 years ago. So I've been missing deadlines really.
But we have four extra years of work that's in it.
This is a very good way of putting it.
I think you should say that you know, had you stopped 4 years ago, the book might have stopped without a lot of beautiful work.
This is true.
And it's available in your local bookstore?
It is. Yeah. Available at all good bookstores.
Or online.
Yeah, and Amazon, it's at number one bestseller.
Number one bestseller.
In Artist Monograph.
And it's published by Thames and Hudson. And it's a beautiful, beautiful object. It's a beautiful book. And it's showing beautiful work. So, you know, on to the next one. If we go back, as we like ritual, tradition, and consistency, if we think about food, it's a question that I always ask at the end of what has today been a wonderful conversation. Food is what we have when we're hungry, when we're tired, when, as you say, you need protein, when you need energy, when you want to feed your children or be fed, it's also comfort. What would be a food you might go to for comfort?
It is my cheese and tomatoes on toast.
Yeah, that's what
it is. Yeah. It is. It's mainly tomatoes and red peppers and with a bit of cheese on top.
Okay.
And, you know, some really good olive oil, some salt and pepper. Make two slices of it, just bake it. Yeah. And then maybe a little glass of wine with that.
See if we're going into the wine and the cheese and the tomatoes. That sounds like a very, very comforting meal. Thank you for today. Thank you for being so my friend.
Thank you.
If you like listening to Ruthie's Table 4, would you please make sure to rate and review the podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.
Ruthie's Table 4 is produced by Atomized Studios for iHeartRadio. It's hosted by Ruthie Rogers. It's produced by Willa Milinski. Our executive producers are Zad Rogers and Faye Stewart. Our production manager is Caitlin Paramore. Special thanks to everyone at the River Cafe.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's Better, H-E-L-P.com.
I'm Stephanie J. Block.
And I'm Mary Lee Fairbanks.
And we host Stages Podcast. Binge close to 100 episodes. Hear the inside stories from backstage and behind the scenes as we go beyond the resume and into the heart of creativity and what it really takes to be in the business of show business.
Don't miss our chats with this season's Tony nominees. If you love theater and entertainment, you are going to love Stages Podcast.
Subscribe to Stages Podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts and visit us at stagespodcast.net.